Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Porto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Porto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Porto. You're listening to Mushing Radio on KVRF 89.5 in Palmer, Alaska, and streaming live on the internet on radiofreepalmer.org. It is day 10 of our mushing coverage of the 2012 Iditarod. And before we do anything else, I want to introduce my co-host, Alex Stein, writer and director of Mush the Movie, calling in from Southern California. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great. We are all very, very excited. It looks like the winner of the Iditarod is about to come into Nome, probably within the next hour and possibly even while we're on the air.
That would be awesome. If we could get that winning announcement here on Mushing Radio, I think all of the stars aligned and we're doing just what we're supposed to do here on Mushing Radio. So let's get into the top 10. And it really doesn't matter much anymore in terms of who's racing who, because we have in first place Dallas Seavey, second place Ali Zirkel, third place a remarkable finish, Ramey Smith, Willow Musher, Ramey Smith, Aaron Burmeister, fourth, Peter Kaiser, fifth, Ray Reddington Jr., sixth, Mitch Seavey, seventh, John Baker, eighth, Mike Williams Jr., ninth, and Didi Genro in 10th. Man, what a race, Alex. It is turning out to be one heck of a run for these guys. What do you have to say about the top mushers there?
You know, it's kind of remarkable. Last night after we went off the air, Ali and Dallas were battling each other going up to White Mountain. And Ali had several times during the evening caught up to Dallas, and then Dallas would pull ahead. Dallas ended up coming into White Mountain a little over an hour in front of her. And then today, aside from there being a tremendous amount of wind on the trail between White Mountain and Nome, the standings have been pretty steady. Ali Zirkel has been 6 or 7 miles behind Dallas pretty much the entire day. Ramey has been about 5 to 7 miles behind Ali, and then Burmeister, of course, has been about 9 to 10 miles behind Ramey. So it's been pretty steady all day in terms of the standings, and there hasn't been very much ground either gained or lost on the part of any of the mushers.
Exactly. And let's talk a little bit about Dallas. And for people that are mushing fans who know the sport of mushing, you can't get a much better pedigree than Dallas Seavey. His grandfather, Dan, is running in the Iditarod this year. He's pulling up the bottom of the pack there. I believe he's in the 53rd place out of 55 mushers. And his dad, who he was battling it out for quite a while, Mitch Seavey, is currently in 7th. His younger brother, Connor, won the junior Iditarod, and his younger brother by not many years, Danny Seavey, is also an Iditarod veteran. You can't beat that. And I want to give a quote to you guys that gives exact example of what Dallas Seavey is talking about when he's on the trail. And this is his quote: "If you're not sleeping, eating, or running, it is wasted time." And that, of course, he's talking about his dogs and the dog team. You know, Dallas is one of those guys that is very disciplined, almost European style musher in terms of the mushers from the past, like Robert Sorley, who has a different type of outlook when you're thinking about running dogs. It's not this willy-nilly, you know, we'll wait and see what happens. It's very disciplined, almost military-like in the way he performs out there on the trail. Do you want to share anything about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And Dallas is an extremely accomplished and confident musher. He won the Yukon Quest a couple years back, and he gave an interview today to the Alaska Public Radio Network in which he talked about how he felt like he was in control for the last half of this race, even when he wasn't in the lead, that he was doing exactly what he wanted to do in terms of his run-rest cycle, and he said he was building up the speed and the endurance of his team as he went along, so that by the time they got to by the time that they got to the coast, which is basically the last third or so of the race, he felt like his team was operating at complete peak efficiency, and he was posting much, much faster run times than most of the other teams, and felt like all he had to do was provide for his dogs and let them go forward. And he referred to it several times as building the monster being this unstoppable dog team that he has.
And let's not take anything away from Ali Zirkle, a remarkable team, a remarkable musher coming in most likely in second place. And then following that is probably the man's man in terms of musher, probably the most blue-collar musher out there. Ramey Smith lives right down the road from me. And there was a story today about just how hungry Ramey Smith is. When you get to know Ramey, he is probably one of the most humble gentlemen I've ever met, but he is on probably the biggest shoestring budget of any musher. Just this past year, he had an encounter with a moose, which is very frequent up here in the Mat-Su Valley of Alaska, and he totaled his dog truck. So he's been ferrying his dogs around willy-nilly, unlike a lot of these other mushers who have these big rigs and big dog trucks that they can take from place to place. He is in it to win it. He needs the cash just as much as anybody else. So Ramey can't go to a better guy coming in third, Ramey Smith. And if we could, just for a second, Alex, let's talk a little bit about the numbers in terms of dollars that are coming in, because this is an important part of the Iditarod. In first place, it will be $50,400 and that new Dodge truck. Second place is not that far back, $46,500. Third place, $42,900. Fourth place, $39,600. And fifth place, $36,500. And I know we talked a little bit about this yesterday. That's not a very big gap in terms of first and fifth place in terms of winnings. What can you say about that?
Absolutely, and I believe we have the complete list of what the winnings are for each place posted on the Facebook page, DogWorks Radio. We're used to thinking of these type of events as having the first prize, the difference between the first prize and the second prize being between 30% and 50%, and to have it only be a few thousand dollars is kind of remarkable. Of course, you don't get the truck. The winner also gets the truck, which I believe is worth $40,000 or $45,000 on its own. So it is obviously everyone who is racing, and especially everyone who's racing and is at this level, wants to win. And winning is more important, I would say, than getting a few thousand extra dollars. But for many of these mushers who are working regular jobs or sometimes working several jobs to try to get the money together to be able to run this race, and as we discussed several times, it's not an inexpensive thing to do. This money certainly makes a huge difference.
And let's not take away from the dogs. Of course, the dogs are the true athletes of this race. And you know, I saw an article today. They would continue on. They don't care if it's Front Street. They would continue on as long as the musher said hike or go or let's go or whatever command they're using. Once they run under that arch, they don't care what's happening. They're either looking for a snack to bed down or go on to the next checkpoint. So for the mushers, it's the excitement of winning. But for the dogs, it's just part of the journey.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit yesterday when we were talking about Karen Ramstead. A lot of the mushers, once they get to the point where they are just outside of Nome and just about to come up the ramp and onto Front Street, will stop and take a few moments just to be with their dogs, to go up and down the line one last time and thank their dogs and talk to their dogs. And in a way, it's these dogs, for the majority of the last 9 or sometimes 10 days, have been out in the middle of nowhere with only their musher. And so before they get into Nome, where there will be hundreds and in the case of the very top winner, thousands of people out on the street, and it will be a confusing kind of thing for some of the dogs, and it will be something where the dogs are perhaps unsure of what's going on, the mushers want to just take a few minutes to thank the dogs and to really make sure that they that the dogs know how much what they've done is appreciated before they get into the madness of the finish.
I know you're watching the GPS tracker on Iditarod Insider or whatever service you have up. Where is Dallas and Allie right now?
It looks like Dallas is about 4 miles outside of Nome, and Allie is still about 7 miles behind him.
That's a tough task to do, to make up that 3 miles in that final 4 or 5 miles. I'm sure that the dogs and the mushers are feeling the excitement now, and I saw a tweet on Twitter just a little while ago that Iditarod Insider was going to mic up Dallas Seavey in the final 5 miles. I would love to be able to hear that. That would be awesome to hear him talking to his dogs and that whole scene there of that last 5 miles. I know he's ready just to get there, get it over with, and celebrate and give his dogs a big hug. But, man, can you imagine what's going on in that last 5 miles?
Yeah, and I'm not sure that we've mentioned this yet, but assuming that Dallas Seavey does win tonight, which it seems all but certain that he will, he will become the youngest musher ever to win the Iditarod.
Right, he's just 25 years old. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is someone who is going to be a huge, enormous force in this sport for decades to come.
Does it sound familiar when you talk about Dan and Mitch?
Yeah. I think it kind of does. And, you know, we've talked about some of these younger mushers and there is kind of a feeling that there's a generational passing of the torch in this. Allie Seavey, I believe, is in her early 40s. So if she had won, then it still would be a bit of the older guard, so to speak. But it definitely feels like there are a handful of young, energetic mushers in their 20s and early 30s who are just taking the sport by storm.
Exactly. And Alex, before we get into our topic today, I know we have a musher we want to talk about. Unless Dallas crosses that finish line, I don't think it's going to happen if he's still 4 miles out in the next 15 minutes. We'll have to tweet about it and talk about it on social media afterwards. But I know you've been there. I haven't had a chance yet, and people have asked me over the last several years, when are you going to go to Nome? And my response has always been, when I'm on the back of the dog sled, I'm not going to do it until then. So whether it be on the Serum Run next year or in the Iditarod in the following years, I don't plan to arrive in Nome at least until I'm on that back of the dog sled. But I know you've been there. So tell us about what happens during when mushers come in throughout the rest of the time, you know, the next 50-some-odd mushers that come in, no matter what time of day, what happens in Nome?
Well, it's a very, very exciting thing, and I should state up front that I wasn't there at when the first mushers came in, but I've been there when sort of the back of the pack mushers start coming in. And for every musher who comes in, day or night, they sound the siren, the town siren. I believe when they're about 2 miles outside of town, and people will pour out from wherever they are and come down to Front Street to the Burled Arch, which is right in front of the Convention and Visitor Center. There's a live webcam for the city of Nome where you can see it, and they've set up a little chute with snow coming up to the Burled Arch, which literally is several gigantic tree trunks that have been furnished together to form an arch, and the banner hangs on top of that, and that's where the finish line is. So when the first musher comes in, there will likely be several thousand people on the street cheering, and lots of press and photographers and media, and it's really an incredibly exciting thing. The great news about the finish in Nome is that because they sound the siren every time a team is coming in, people will rush out even if it's the middle of the night, even if it's 3 in the morning. And one of the things that most impressed me is that obviously a lot of the mushers, when they get in, are completely exhausted, and after a little while they have to go and sleep and shower and do all sorts of things like that. But even at the very back of the pack, mushers who've finished already will come out and greet the mushers who are coming in. And I think for people who are not in that top group or the second group that we've talked about a lot, but the people who are the back of the packers and the rookies, I think it really means a lot to have not only the champion but dozens of other mushers who will come out and greet them when they finish.
Alex, if you don't mind, let's stay on this topic for a little while. This is very interesting, and I know we had some other topics we want to talk about, but, you know, this is what people want to hear. They want to hear about the finish. And my question to you, again, since I haven't been there, when you were filming and doing interviews with these folks in preparation for your movie, Mush the Movie, tell me about talking with somebody that you interviewed before the race, you know, up before that whole hoopla of getting started in Anchorage and then in Willow, and then having that chance to talk with them shortly thereafter, you know, coming into Nome. What was that experience like for them? What did they say? If you care to, who was it that you spoke to? Give us a little story about that beginning to end finish with somebody you spoke with.
Sure. One of the great things about Iditarod is that you will literally run into the same people over and over again. So you'll see the same people in Anchorage at the ceremonial start, and then you'll see them in Willow, and then you'll see them at various checkpoints, and then you'll see them again in Nome. And when you see these people that you've seen at several points along the race, and they're in Nome, it's almost as if you have survived this amazing thing together. And that is the way it feels when you are around people who are just the volunteers or the journalists. And certainly we are not going through the same thing that any of the mushers are going through. I can only imagine the feeling that the mushers must have when they know that they have this amazing shared experience of coming through 1,000 miles on the back of a dog sled. But I would run into, for example, some of the vet techs who I saw at the vet check in Willow a few days before the race, and then I would see them at checkpoints, and then I would run into them in Nome, and they all had their war stories. They all had their things that they were very proud of, whether it was helping someone or whether it was, you know, the fact that dogs had gotten very good care or some, you know, minor gossip about what one musher said or something like that. I also managed to run into a lot of people who were just fans whom I had met either in Willow or in Anchorage who had decided based on experiencing the beginning of the Iditarod that they wanted to come up to Nome and see the end of it. And most of these people were just thrilled to be a part of this race, even if being a part of it really meant just witnessing it. And so that was always very exciting. And, you know, there were people I met from South Africa and people from Australia and people from all parts of the United States and Canada who just were so enchanted by the race that they wanted to come to the finish in Nome. There's also, Nome is a relatively small city, and there are a couple of hotels and a few bed and breakfasts, but there really aren't very many rooms to be had in Nome. And what a lot of people end up doing who come to the to Nome to see the finish is the Convention and Visitors Center registers local people who have spare bedrooms or couches or somewhere where they can accommodate someone who's coming in from outside and doesn't have a hotel room, and they sort of coordinate where everybody is going to stay. So you end up staying in someone's home, and you pay them, but it's kind of, it's a way to feel like you are a part of the community in a small way that you might not feel if you were just, you know, staying at the Gnome Nugget or something like that.
So when you were following these guys, the back of the Packers, you know, we talked a lot about those guys on this show, and we will continue to talk about them in our coverage over the next coming days. Describe to our listeners some of that emotion that those guys exhibited when they finally crossed that finish line. And just to give an example, last year, John Baker came in 9 days, some plus hours. I don't remember exactly the time, but it was a 9-day time frame. And the Red Lantern winner, the last musher to come into Gnome, was well over 5 days behind him. So can you describe what you witnessed there in terms of emotion for some of these back-of-the-pack guys? What did they do? Did they just kind of jump off their sled and walk off? Or did they, you know, did they break down and cry? What did you see when you saw these guys coming through that arch?
In general, there was an enormous sense of accomplishment and relief. Most of them had at least one or two family members or spouses who were there to greet them, and it was such an amazing, pure emotional feeling when these people would finish. Because in some cases, the people who are in the back of the pack, it's not clear if they're going to finish. It's not clear if they, you know, if their dogs are going to hold up, or if they're, if they had some kind of minor injury, it's not clear whether that's going to be enough to sideline them. And the sense of accomplishment that they have when they come in is one of the most pure and human and amazing things I've ever experienced. And it's really all the more moving because people come out to greet them, and people don't care if they are, you know, number one or number five or number 60. The people who are there in Gnome really want to celebrate this amazing accomplishment that someone and a group of 16 dogs has been able to, you know, has been able to accomplish. And in a lot of cases, this is the culmination of a dream that they have had and they have harbored and they have nurtured for many, many years. And to be able to be there when someone's dream comes true is really just a remarkable thing.
If I can interject there just a second, Alex, I've been mushing towards this dream. My first time on the back of a dog sled was 1990. And here we are, 2012, so 22 years later, and I'm still trying to capture that that quest to Gnome. Of course, I took a long break so I could raise my kids, and we learned that, you know, mushing and young, very young kids doesn't mix too well because of school and things. But I just recently got back into it. But this has been a 22-year journey for me, and it's the same for a lot of guys. You know, you'll often see mushers saying, you know, I got involved in, you know, 2004 or 2005, and here it is 2012, and they're running that first Iditarod. So this isn't like training for a marathon or, you know, some other type of event where you can, you know, train and get it up and get it ready and be ready to go in a year or so. This is something that takes years and years of building up and time and resources and money in order to accomplish.
Yeah, and I think because of that, it has a little bit, it's a little bit more self-selecting. So people who might casually think, oh, I'm just going to run the Iditarod, when they find out what's really involved, might be dissuaded. So the people who really persevere and follow this dream all the way through are, you know, I don't want to get too bubbly about it, but I think that these are really people who are very, very special people and very devoted to making their dreams come true.
Have they sounded the siren yet? I know they were going to tweet about that when they did.
No, I don't believe so. It looks like Mitch. It looks like Dallas is still about 3 miles out.
Okay.
So I think we are just going to miss him. I think he's going to come in right after we get off the air.
That's fine. We've talked about it and built it up enough where I feel confident that we did our job at least as best as we could here on the radio. So in the last few minutes, we want to make sure, I know we wanted to talk about the competitive rule and all that. We can talk about that a different day. Maybe we can write a blog post about it or something. But let's talk about our featured musher today. I know we want to get that in every day. That was one of the things we wanted to do every day. You want to talk about Bruce Linton. Let's talk about him. Alex, we only have about 3 minutes.
Okay, I will try to make it as quick as possible then. Bruce Linton is a musher who's running his sixth Iditarod. Each time he's run, he's finished farther and farther, closer and closer to the top. His first finish was somewhere in the 50s. Although this certainly doesn't define who he is, one of the interesting things about Bruce is that he is a type 1 diabetic, an insulin-dependent diabetic. He is not a large guy. He's not a fat guy, but he was diagnosed about 20 years ago when he was 30, and he was in very good health and didn't understand why this happened and then started learning more and more about it and discovered one day that his blood sugar levels were more regular, more predictable, if he would run a little bit. And he hadn't been a runner before, but he started running. And then he started running marathons. And he lived in Vermont. He ran 12 marathons, and then he thought that that was really amazing and inspiring. And then he started running Ironman triathlons. And he got interested in running dogs and started a dog sled touring company in Vermont. And then that kind of took over his life, and he realized he didn't really have enough time to train the dogs when he was running this company, so he moved to Kisilov, Alaska. And when he ran his first Iditarod, and he was told when he started doing the marathons and triathlons, you really shouldn't do this, it's not good for you, you know, as a diabetic, you need to limit what you're doing. And he's the kind of guy who doesn't really believe in doing that. So when he ran his first Iditarod, he had to position insulin kits and insulin checks at various of the checkpoints, because if you're out on the trail and it's 45 below zero and you have this liquid insulin that you're supposed to inject, it can and does freeze. So his first year running it, there was that logistical thing as well. He has a great quote. I spoke to him at the beginning of, I believe, the 2010 race, and he said, "I don't believe people should be limited by their disease. You can only be limited by your own dreams." And I think that kind of ties in with what we've been talking about with people who really decide that they want to run the Iditarod and then go about finding a way to make that happen.
That's awesome stuff. Alex, we're about out of time. It's been a pleasure to have you on throughout the coverage, and we'll make sure that we're on tomorrow. We're going to talk about some of the next group of mushers coming in tomorrow afternoon. Several of them will come in tonight. So until then, Alex, we'll talk to you again soon. This is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. Make sure you check us out on our podcast at mushingradio.com. Should be up in an hour or two. After that, we'll talk about Dallas Seavey on the Internet. Talk to you very soon. Goodbye.